Welcome to Everything Cancer, the empowering podcast for the cancer journey. I am Jill, your host, a longtime certified oncology nurse, cancer support group facilitator, and person striving to get the word out there about the proven power of effective self-advocacy on the cancer journey. This podcast is designed for those on the journey, those who love them, and also for providers to offer them a fresh and enlightening perspective. We have an engaging and warm spectrum of guests, from survivors to providers, both very inspiring, and cancer support organizations that offer amazing services, and to hear about managing symptoms and gaining a higher quality of life. We've got it all. We'll be discussing rekindling the intimacy after cancer changed your world. We'll break down practicing self-advocacy into easy-to-do bite-sized pieces. We'll talk about everything cancer. The Everything Cancer podcast is not intended as a substitute for medical advice. Please consult with your healthcare team about any concerns you may have. The Everything Cancer podcast staff will not be answering any health concern questions. Thank you. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Everything Cancer, the extra large suitcase of the cancer journey. Today, we have an extra special treat with Salma Harfouche, who goes by Sal. She is a marketing and branding specialist who happens to love cows. So we're going to hear about that, and has an amazing sense of humor and is an incredibly vibrant person who has been on an incredible cancer journey and is continuing on it. And Sal, we met on LinkedIn when you remarked to someone who was talking about fighting cancer, that people remarked to you that you are so strong, and you responded back, "I'm not strong. I didn't have a choice." And I responded to you, "I would argue that, as you chose to be engaged in your care and work with your cancer care team."
Yeah. And I think that gave me so much to think about. Honestly, I've had people, like my friends, say, like, "I don't know what I would have done in your situation. I don't think I would have been able to have handled it the same way." And I would always say, you know, I feel like I never had a choice. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things where you have two options, right? You're either going to do nothing and die, or just try to figure out what was wrong with me. And I think I'm just naturally the type of person that is super curious, and I hate the unknown. I hate unsolved mysteries.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what happens. They drive me insane. So I think that drive to just find out, like, what is actually going on. Everything in my body was perfectly fine. And we'll definitely go into why I didn't show other symptoms mm-hmm. in a little bit. Because I definitely think that's important mm-hmm. for other types of cancers
yes.
too.
Yes.
And also, I just know how much my parents love me. So I did it for them.
I love you.
You know what I mean? I was like, well, yeah. I can't just die. Like,
right.
my mom's going to be so upset. So
right.
like, let me go try and figure it out for them. And also too, I was going to the gym every day. I was trying so hard to just be my healthiest self.
Uh-huh.
And to put so much effort and then not see any result from it, I kind of was like, okay, this is weird. Normally when people work out, they lose weight. I was unable to lose weight. No matter how much I went to the gym, I went every day, and I did cardio for like 1 or 2 hours every day, which
wow. they were off the
yeah, I was like, yo, I could have really pushed myself into a heart attack. But my oncologist was like, actually, I think that made your heart stronger. So you were actually able to fight the tumor better. So I was like, okay, good thing me being crazy worked out very well. So I think a lot of it was me really wanting to prove something to people, because I had so many doctors gaslight me. A lot of them called me a hypochondriac. And at that point, I was so angry. I wasn't even sad. I kind of expected to get diagnosed. I didn't think it was going to be heart cancer. I mm-hmm. actually thought it was breast cancer. Because one of my breasts, like all women, one is bigger than the other, but mm-hmm. it's such a huge difference. And it comes
yeah.
to find out that my tumor hindered the growth of like one side of my body. So one side of my body is a little shorter than the other. But I would have had no idea. I just thought like, oh, this is normal, because we get told all the time, this is normal. And sometimes it's not normal. And I think if we just validate people a little bit more, I think it would go a very long way. You know, honestly, I'm totally okay with dying, and I've always been okay with dying. But my biggest fear was dying from being sick, because I've seen people go through hell. And the reality is, it's not even the sickness that brings upon this kind of dread. It's really the way it's handled by healthcare professionals, your family, because they just don't understand. So for me, it was like, you know what? I'm not going to go down without a fight. Like, I'm going to be out here kicking and screaming. And I really do think that drive to keep me going was more of just like an ego thing. Like, I just wanted to be right. Some people are like, you're so strong. I'm like, listen, I'm just angry. I was just so angry. Because when you know something's wrong with you and people like make you think you're crazy, it's one of the worst feelings to have.
Yes.
It really is. Yes. You start to question your sanity big time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things we talked about before we started this interview, which kind of segues into what you're saying, is documenting your symptoms to be able to present a data-driven big picture to your providers.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So that definitely, the way I advocated for myself has changed drastically throughout the years. My first time when I was 17 that I decided to go on my own, and I was so gaslit. He was like, I brought up the fact that I would be sleeping, like, at that point it was probably 10 hours every day, and I would still feel so fatigued. And he was like, well, that's normal. You're growing. You're in high school. You're studying. And I was just flat out like, bro, I'm like almost failing. Like, I'm definitely not studying that hard. Like, this is not me. Like, I kept trying to reason, and flew over his head.
So he's thinking it's normal teenage angst that you're saying you're fatigued. And meanwhile, your ass is dragging, like, really, really bad. And he's not getting it.
He's not getting it. It really started to get really bad when I was 19. So I was going to someone new every single month when I was 19, which was hectic because I was going to college full time, and I had to tell my professors. I was very honest. I was like, listen, there's something medically going on with me. Nobody believes me. I cannot come to your class today. I need to drive 2 hours away to this appointment. And that's what I would do. I was labeled a hypochondriac, drug seeking, faking it. Literally whatever they decided to throw at me.
And you're amazing. So someone, you facing the providers that you were seeing, the doctors you were seeing, and you're telling them this, probably 99 out of 100 people walking into their office saying what you're saying.
But yeah, my cancer didn't spread because it was on my heart. But I lived with this for 20 years.
If
it was anywhere else, I'd be dead right now. I would have probably cancer all over my body. Sometimes I'm like driving and I'm like, oh my God, like, you had cancer. It was so surreal for me.
Right.
Because it happened so young.
Right.
And it happened so fast. I'll break down the timeline a little bit later. It happened ridiculously fast. I think I got diagnosed June 14th, and I got my surgery June 28th. That's how dire my situation is. They were like, I'm not even going to do chemo. You have a ticking time bomb on your heart. Like, we need to get that out now. And I'm glad my doctors listened to me, because I told them the first moment that they showed me my mass on the CT, I was like, can we just get surgery? Can we just remove this? Because I don't feel like doing, let's just remove it. I've never heard of another situation like mine, to be honest. Most leiomyosarcomas, which, by the way, is hilarious. That name is hilarious. When they told me I had leiomyosarcoma, I started dying laughing. I was like, what kind of name is this? I thought it was fake. I was like, leiomyosarcoma.
But it was of your heart. I mean, that's the thing. It was of your heart.
They usually get it in the uterus.
Right. I was just going to say the uterus. Yep.
Yeah. Which, you know, gives me anxiety. You know, I don't, that wasn't where it originated, but all it takes is one cell. And that's so scary to think about, but all it takes is one to go rogue and just go undetected. And so...
So you almost passed out one day, right? Or you actually passed out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that got you into an emergency room, right?
Yes. So that's,
okay.
That's exactly where I was going to go to. So in 2018, I was 20. I started to experience this really weird sensation. I would walk just 10 steps, which is crazy. It's just 10 steps.
Yeah.
And I would start seeing like tunnel vision. Wow. And then just flat out black. And I was like, okay, but I'm still conscious. I really want to just finish this degree so I can, because that was my last class before medical school.
Wow. Like, I was, wow.
So close. And I was like, no, I just want to finish this class. Thank God I went. I went home, I napped, and I felt better. But I just, something kept telling me, like, you need to go. So I was like, Mom, let's go to this different hospital. Let's try a different place. So I went in there, and I was like, listen, I'm having a pulmonary embolism. So I did tell them that, and they, without hesitation, without even blinking, they were like, okay, yeah, sure. And they gave me a CT scan. And it was just like, wow, like I tried so hard the last 20 years, and I just went to this one place. So for me, it's like, now I see advocating so differently. Now it's not this like uphill battle. Now I see it more as like, it just takes one person to change your life. Just one. So even if you have to go to 21, that 21st might be the person that listens. So, you know, it's, that's not to say I don't, that's not to say I don't still experience gaslighting, because I do. But I kind of know how to handle it better. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but once you have history, they listen more.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate that it's like that. But once they find out, okay, this girl had heart cancer. Yeah, we need to check all her organs like now. They're just very paranoid, especially now that I have the pacemaker. And I just recently got it. I got it in October. Mm-hmm. And it's been rough. Oh, my God. It's been rough. I went through 2 heart surgeries at 20. And honestly, that was a breeze. But actually getting the pacemaker and changing my valve was way harder. And I'm still recovering, still getting weird symptoms. And I still have to fight with doctors right now to figure out what are these weird sensations I'm feeling post-surgery. But I think, like you said, once you start advocating for yourself, it just gets easier. Because now you know what to say, how to log your symptoms, which is why I think your book is so brilliant. Like,
thank you.
A lot of people don't know how to advocate, mm-hmm. so they don't do it, or they just like don't want to because they have so much anxiety around it.
Right.
And I can understand that, because honestly, it's not our fucking job. Like, sorry to get all cursing.
It's okay. Here, but it's okay. This is for real. Yeah.
There are some situations where like maybe you can't 100% fully make it, beat it, but you bought that time to spend with your family. And I think personally, it's kind of morbid. Any of us can die.
Yes,
any second of any day. It doesn't
matter. It's not morbid. Or healthy. It's life.
It's life. And it's just like, at that point, then I actually rather get cancer because I can say bye to the people I love. Whereas in a car accident, you don't really get to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of reframing is really important too with advocacy.
Right.
Because like, you shouldn't see it as like, oh my God, I'm basically fighting to get a death sentence, because you don't even know if it's a death sentence.
Right.
You know, in my situation, it wasn't.
I mean, it's totally different from your situation, but look at the metastatic lung cancer and metastatic breast cancer medications that are out there now, where people are living for years with metastatic cancer.
It's so beautiful.
But it is beautiful. But in those instances, it is so important still to track your symptoms, or if you have survivorship issues and symptoms from your previous treatment, acute treatment, you need to communicate that so that you get help with those, so you have a better quality 100%. Of life. And like you were talking about your friends, that some of them ended up with 3 years instead of 3 months, but hopefully those were 3 years where they had a good quality of life and their symptoms were well managed up until, you know, it just was taking over. And that communication with your doctors is so, and with all of your providers, and tracking your symptoms is so important. And quick interruption, the book is on Amazon, and it is called Cancer Journey Guide and Journals, Empowerment in Diagnosis, Treatment, and Beyond. Jill Squire, you can find it on Amazon. It's blue. You can't miss it, but let's go back to you. So you had this, they did the scan, and then they sent you to a heart surgeon, right?
Oh my God. you just reminded me, like, the journey was nuts. First of all, please, everyone, go get that book. But even if you don't have cancer, I think that that book could be very, very valuable, because there's people out here dealing with so many diseases. They have no idea how to track their symptoms. They have no idea how to even express it or communicate with their doctor. At least if you're noting everything down in the book, you can just hand it to your doctor and be like, hey, this is what I've been journaling. Do you think you can just look through this and maybe we could figure out what's going wrong? It's really important to stay on top of your symptoms, especially after survivorship, because the reality is we have recurrences. We do. Mm-hmm. It sucks. And for someone like me, my cancer type, sarcomas are really aggressive. So the likelihood that it'll come back is pretty high. And I'm not a pessimist, but I am a realist. And it gets dangerous once you're stage 3, stage 4. So I think if you get this book and you're really mm-hmm. diligent on tracking things, it's going to be way easier for you to, you know, see any of the red flags and be like, hey, this is what's happening. Let's take some action.
Thank you. I appreciate that. If you don't get the book, if you log everything, if you write everything down, if you journal it, that's so important. The book walks you through steps of self-advocacy. Yeah. But in any case, back to you, Sal. Yes, and your story is so... it's okay. Your story is so amazing. Symptom management, feeling good, well-being, wellness, engaging in life is so important at any point on the cancer journey, from diagnosis to 100, whenever. And that's you taking your life back. Yeah. That is you saying, I'm going to be engaged and I'm going to enjoy whatever I can, however I can.
Yeah, 100%. It's the difference between being an agent in your life and just letting life happen to you.
Exactly.
Because, like, listen, we're all going to have life happen to us, but the least mm-hmm. you can do is kind of just step up and be like, I'm not going to be someone that just lets things happen to me. I'm going to actually be an active participant in making my life better. Like, you can go through cancer and have the best mindset, be so happy. And that's how I felt when I was going through my cancer stuff. Like, I wasn't scared. I wasn't even sad. Honestly, I didn't even cry. And that might have been from shock. But I also just felt like, what's the point? Like, that's not going to help my situation. Like, I think the best thing I can do for myself is enjoy my family, mm-hmm. watch a bunch of scary movies so I can see someone going through something worse than I am, uh-huh. which actually helped me. Like, seeing someone else get murdered, I was like, yeah, I'll take cancer. I'm cool. Uh-huh. I'm good with that. And I think just really embodying yourself into a healthy mindset is what's going to help you survive it. And I do think that tracking your symptoms and stuff like that, even though it seems a little bit like Debbie Downer, actually, I went to that hospital, got a CT scan, and I think right away they realized, like, we can't help this bitch. Like, there's nothing we can do. They realized very early on. So after the scan, they were like, hey, we're going to have you stay overnight. And that's when I knew. I was like, okay, we found something. Yeah. We found something. The next morning, my cardiologist, who I still see, she comes in and she is like, I guess I could see from her face, because I was really young, she was like trying to handle how
to say this. Me. Yeah.
And but, you know, she started off very calm and nice. And I was like, so what's going on? Like, what do we do? What do we need to do? What is it? Like, how do we do this? How do we fix this? And she was just like, wow, okay. This girl just wants to get this solved. And I was like, yeah, dude, like, for me at this point, I already knew I was sick. I just wanted to know what the heck it was.
Right.
This was driving me insane.
Right. For years.
For years. I was just like, what is it? Mm-hmm. What is it? Turns out it was my heart. And wow, when she showed me the CT scan, it was crazy. The tumor was 17 centimeters, which is huge.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah. And it actually moved my heart towards the more of the, like, the side of my body.
Wow. Yeah, I could see where it would shift it. No wonder.
Crazy. Crazy. And I saw the scan and I started laughing. I just don't handle things well. I just start laughing. That's just how I am. Everyone looked at me like I was psychotic. I explained to them, like, I'm just really in shock right now. And I thought it was something, but I didn't think it was going to be this.
Right.
So
that's bigger than this mug.
It was,
you know,
huge.
Pushing against your heart. Ooh, yeah.
Ooh. And the thing is, it was on top of it. And that's why I started to get you know, those blackouts because it was not.
It couldn't pump. It couldn't. Yes. The ventricles couldn't refill with blood because there was too much room being taken up. Yeah. And you couldn't. Yeah. My gosh, Sal.
Oh my God, it was so my scary.
Gosh.
I'm
like, yeah.
I'm like, oh my God. Still to this day, I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy.
And yeah.
It happened 6 years ago, and I'm like, for me, I'm still shocked because it's just like I've never heard of this in my life. Would love to make a movie about this one day. I think we'd make a great horror movie, but
you have to have cows in it though.
I will.
Okay.
I will definitely
feed cows somehow. But at that in a nice way, in a nice way. Yes.
They're going to be like, and it's interesting because during my cancer battle, I actually didn't use cows as like my spirit animal. I actually used flamingos.
I love it. I love it.
I had like everything flamingo and I was like, well, I didn't even really understand why my mom kept bringing me flamingo things because she's just like that type of person. Like, I'm just going to bring you things. I'm like, okay, cool. And it was all flamingo themed. So I was like, okay, maybe she knows something that I don't. Turns out they're very resilient creatures.
They are. And they're always upright.
They're always upright.
Yeah.
So my mom was like, this is perfect. But at the time I was just like, flamingos are cool. So for me, because they've never seen this before, even my cardiologist has never seen this before, they didn't really know what it was. They were like, maybe this is a cyst. Maybe it's benign. Because benign heart tumors are a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're rare, but they're not as rare as, mm-hmm. you know, malignant ones. So they totally thought this was not an emergency. So mind you, I've never had a cavity. I've never had anything happen in my life. So the next day she comes in, she's like, listen, we're going to drain your heart. Like, we're going to drain the tumor.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, okay, cool. I thought I was going to be asleep. I was awake. And it was like a huge, huge needle. And I was awake the whole time. And this was like a horror movie. This was actually the worst experience of my life. I was like, this is really traumatic. But I'm actually weirdly glad that was one of the first things because it made everything else easier
mm-hmm.
because the rest,
that's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. I was the worst, I guess, situation.
You got out of the way. Rest, yeah.
Yeah. It made the rest kind of feel a little bit better. Cause every time I'd go into procedure, I would think about that freaking needle draining thing. They're literally stabbing me. And I'm like, like it was horrible.
Oh my gosh.
And the freaking radiologist is like, don't look down. Just look into my eyes. I'm like, bro, you're wearing glasses. I see everything. I just see it reflected back.
Did you say that to him? Oh, my gosh.
I feel less nervous when I talk to the doctor while they're doing the procedure, but like they need to concentrate. The next day, literally the next day, the tumor refilled with fluid.
So that wasn't all for nothing because then they knew something was really
up.
They were like, so, yeah.
They were appalled and they're like, okay, we need to just get an open heart surgery. I woke up out of that surgery thinking I didn't have a tumor anymore. I was so happy. And then they came into the room. They're like, listen, we have some bad news. We opened it up. Our surgeon here actually used to work at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And he saw your tumor and he was like, this is cancerous. This is no way benign.
Yeah.
So they closed me back up.
Yeah, that happens. It happens. But they also knew when they were in over their heads, which is just as important, to be honest.
Totally.
It is so important.
Totally. Because he was like, listen, even though I have the expertise, like, I'm not mm-hmm. going to do that for you because we're just not a cancer center.
Right.
So
thank God.
At that point, they were discussing whether to send me to Mayo Clinic or John Hopkins.
Uh-huh.
And got into Memorial Sloan Kettering. Went in there, I want to say, like, maybe June 10th. And of course, as you know, pathology takes forever.
Yeah, it does. It's very frustrating. But they're doing their job right.
They're doing their
which
job.
Which is why it takes so long.
It takes so long.
But and it's so frustrating.
When people say, like pathology takes forever. I'm like, listen, they have cultures that they have to dissect throughout like a period of days.
Mm-hmm.
They got to see like how it acts within mm-hmm. a few days period to be able to diagnose you. So I understood that. My parents didn't. They were very frustrated. But I kind of explained to them like, this is the way it is. We just have to wait. And it's so funny because I felt like I was the adult in the situation a lot of the time. You know, I was the one that was, and God bless my parents because they're very, very positive people. Mm-hmm. They never once cried in front of me. And I'm sure they did cry hysterically, but
I'm sure
never in front of me. They were always joking. They tried to keep me in good spirits. And I think that's such a huge thing when you're going through this. Like, you need to stay in good spirits.
Right.
I don't care what you have to do. I smoked a lot of weed. during my whole cancer journey. Right. No regrets. I feel like it made me so happy, accepting, I would say. I'd be like, okay, well, I'm in this situation, but I can't help but giggle because I'm high. So for me, it was like I was able to eat. I was able to keep myself happy. And you know, being able to eat during chemo is so important because I feel sad. And it's like, just get high, dude. Just eat some food. Get some munchies. Oncologist ended up getting formally diagnosed by MSK on June 14th. And they actually did not want to do my surgery. They were like, listen, we think if we put you across the street with this really, really top-notch heart doctor who has also taken out tumors before, we think he's going to be able to help you more. So I got sent from MSK to right across the street, which is NYP, New York Presbyterian, Weill Cornell. And my doctor was Dr. Girardi. He's incredible. Like,
yeah.
I fangirl over him. So it was just so fast. Diagnosis date was June 14th. My surgery was June 28th.
Wow.
So fast. And I got discharged from the hospital July 5th. This was like 2 weeks. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I feel like from May 31st to July 5th, everything happened. And it was just like, holy cow. I've never experienced anyone else that goes through such a fast process when it comes to treatment. So that's kind of made me realize, like, your situation was really dire if they really felt like they needed to move it that fast. They wanted to wait until, and actually my scar is a little interestingly shaped. There's like this open part. I had 4 cycles of chemo in total and then 1 month of radiation. That's it. I've been good ever since.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've been good ever since.
Yeah.
But there's ending treatment and thinking everything's great.
Oh,
and suddenly you're on the journey of survivorship. And I think a really good way to segue into that is what happened with you and your boyfriend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was with someone for 5 years at that point. So that was like most of my life. I believe we started dating when I was like 17 until 21.
Wow.
We made it a very long way.
Yeah.
And that was my best friend. That was like my everything. That was the person I thought I was going to marry. And in the beginning, he was insanely supportive, especially when I was in the hospital. But our relationship really started to fall apart when I started going through chemo. I lost my hair. I know so many of my friends or colleagues or even people in support groups that say losing my hair was the hardest part of cancer. Yeah,
it is. It's a very hard thing to go through.
I was so excited to be bald. I couldn't wait. I've always wanted to shave my head. My parents were like, absolutely not. So when I went bald, I was like, yo, mom, I look fly. Like, I felt good. I loved it. But I can't it was weird. I feel like I had such a beautiful rebirth and more confidence than I ever had. And I felt like I was really growing into myself and trusting myself. And oddly enough, me changing, being more independent, actually ruined my relationship. I was no longer depending on this man for emotional support and all these things. And he started to say, well, it feels like we're friends now. It doesn't even feel like we're in a relationship. And it was hard for me because they never tell you this, but when you go through chemo, your vagina does not work the same. It does not. I lost a period for a year. And then, you know, now I don't really have one. It's on and off. But I did lose my period for a year. And all of the membranes in there kind of dried up. So having sex was agonizingly painful. And I really did try for my partner. I was like, you know, I could do this. I was like, I'll just deal with the pain. I'm already in pain. But like that pain was so tremendous that I was like, listen, I can't do this. And I think for him not having the physical intimacy, because I didn't want to hug anyone. Like I had just gone through chemo. Like I want to lay in my bed, chill, be stoned, and just relax. And he just couldn't understand that. And I get it, because he probably had a lot of emotional things going on at the same time. And I couldn't be there for him. But that's because I was trying to be there for myself. And I do feel like cancer can really kill or like enlighten your relationship. Yeah. Your partner is either going to stand up and be there for you and hold your hand through it and prioritize you instead of looking at their feelings, or they're going to get so consumed by their experience throughout the whole thing that they kind of forget that, like, yo, you're the one that has to go through these things.
There's that.
Right.
And then there's also the shift of romantic partner to caregiver.
Yeah.
And then how do you go from caregiver back to romantic partner?
Right.
That's a tough thing. It's a tough, it's a very tough thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I definitely think, you know, for those that are married, it's such a good idea to go to counseling for it.
Yes.
Go see someone before you even start treatment. Yeah. In my opinion, like before you even start anything, like that's just my biggest mistake was not getting a therapist during treatment. I got mine after treatment. I feel like I really, even though I was happy during my treatment, I really think I could have benefited from having a mental health professional being like, okay, but how are you really feeling?
Right.
Like, you know, I get that you're going through all these things, and because it happens so fast, you don't have time to think about your feelings.
Right.
I did not have time to sit and be like, damn, like this is really happening. I was just like, okay, what's the next step? What are we going to do? How long does it take for me to get back to school? Like, my mind wasn't anywhere around my feelings. So I feel like a lot of us in the first place don't know how to process these kinds of things. And to have to process it with a partner makes it even harder. Because it's like, how do you process these things with somebody when you can't even process it with yourself?
That's gold guidance to get a therapist, to see somebody. And a lot of, you know, for some people that's out of reach for them financially because they're already doling out a ton of co-pays for treatment, but a lot of cancer support organizations that are local will offer free counseling up through six sessions. And and maybe even more. But those six sessions will make a huge difference. And then there's also an organization called cancercare.org who has oncology social workers who will also help with counseling. So there's resources out there where you're not having to dole out more co-pays.
And or at honestly, least, in,
right.
Sorry, even support groups.
Right. Oh, support groups are huge.
Huge. I feel like the support groups that I've been part of help me even more than a therapist. Yes. Because at the end of the day, like, I love my therapist, but he has no idea what I've been through. Like, he does, but he doesn't actually understand. But at a support center, you guys can totally relate to each other. And just not feeling alone, honestly, it's a little thing, but it goes a long way.
Goes a very long way. That shared experience is makes a huge difference. And I mean, I'm not living in those shoes, but I facilitate a support group and I see, I hear, I feel from the expressions on people's faces and the set of their shoulders, what's happening in that shared experience. Yeah. And it's amazing. It really is. It's so worth. People often say after they join, I don't understand why I took so long to join, or I'm sorry I did. It makes a big difference.
Yeah. And just knowing you can help people that way is amazing. And I know that you asked, you know, have I reached out to help others since being diagnosed? I documented everything online. You know, that's just how I am. I'm just such an oversharer. And I'm so glad I did, because so many people reached out to me and they're like, okay, I'm going through this experience, that experience, blah, blah, blah. I never thought I was going to hear from someone, I have heart cancer too, because
it
seems so rare.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, so like, we're good. This is it. And nobody have to deal with this again. But it's good to like, just let people know what's going on. So, and she's from the UK. She's a scientist. She was a chemist like me. I was a chemist. And she experienced kind of the same symptoms I did. And it turns out she had an angiosarcoma of the heart. These poor women were so healthy. Like, one of them was completely vegan. The other one had been in sports her entire life. She could run. She could run. So for me, it was like, why did I survive and these women didn't? And that's such a hard question. And I, of course, every single survivor has that question.
Right.
Because it was like, they did everything right.
Mm-hmm.
Why did my body survive this thing and theirs didn't, even though they were healthier, right? It sounds really scary. We could be walking around with cancer right now and we don't even know. We don't even know. That was really hard, because the second girl, she really fought so hard.
Mm.
And she was revolutionary. She like won an award in the UK for biotech. She was like killing it. She had her own biotech company and she was astounding. And she was going to change the world with, you know, biotech medicine. And it's just like we got robbed of such a beautiful human being because her doctors also didn't believe her. And again, thank God I had my videos because, you know, she showed them the evidence because I logged my evidence. I showed the fluid that they drained, which, by the way, was 700 milliliters of fluid.
Oh, my gosh. Chest. That's huge. Yeah. Yeah.
Almost a liter.
Wow.
And I documented everything. I'm grateful I did document everything. I'm grateful I'm still helping people get diagnosed. And that's something I love to do. But it's so hard. It's so hard because honestly, it sounds bleak. We have no idea who is going to make it and who is not.
There are no guarantees.
No guarantees.
The things you can do are engage with your healthcare team, engage with yourself, practice self-awareness, live life.
Yeah.
And spend time with who you want to spend time with and fight for yourself, fight for yourself. Wow, that's like so intense.
Go get a second opinion. Go get a 20th opinion if you need to. And one of your questions was, you know, if my oncology and my team is how they handle me asking for a second opinion, they're all for it.
Yeah. So one of the things you and I talked about is you have to get scanned every 3 months. And yes. Yeah, that's to watch for recurrence. And that's part of taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. But it has the specter of recurrence hanging over your head with this 3-month reminder. So can you talk a little bit about that, Sal?
Yeah, 100%. So for me, and it's so annoying, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this. It's so annoying where people are like, oh my God, but why are you thinking that way? You might never get it again. Listen, that's just not our reality.
Right.
We did get it. We got it once. Why can't we get it again? So for me, it's not even like, oh, I'm thinking pessimistic. I'm just very realistic. I really like to know if something's wrong with me and get it fixed. I'm actually not scared of getting diagnosed. I'm scared of not getting diagnosed.
Right. You're actually doing best practice.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that you're being pessimistic. It's that you want to catch it early if it comes back.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not being a Debbie Downer. It's taking good care of yourself.
So I think what's really important to manage anxiety around recurrence is reframing your mindset. Instead of being like, I'm scared to get diagnosed, you can say, I'm scared to get undiagnosed. I'm scared to not get diagnosed or misdiagnosed.
Right.
And then another thing is I try my best not to worry about something until I get bad news. That's something that has been so helpful to me, even outside of cancer, because I think it's so easy for us to think of a situation and be like, oh my God, but what if it doesn't work out? Or what if I choke? Or what if I blank out? Or what if I fail? Listen, you're going to let whatever happen. Mm-hmm. I'm a very big believer in the universe. You know, even if you don't believe in God, you can believe in the universe because at the end of the day, every action has a reaction. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was more of just like, okay, why are we going to stress ourselves out, give ourselves anxiety, and put our body in a very unhealthy environment?
You faced your mortality in a very large way.
Yeah.
And now you're like, hey, I'm here. I'm going to do the best I can to take care of myself. And I'm going to enjoy life. I'm going to be engaged. I'm going to love cows. And you completely, like you said, reframed your mindset around that. Right. Yeah.
It's a huge part of it. And now, honestly, I never think about death in such a weird way. I feel like cancer freed me from all of the things that was holding me back from life. Even that partner that I had at that time.
Yeah.
He's a great guy, but he was not for me. And of course, it was life ending for me too after treatment. After treatment is really hard. Mm-hmm. And we did talk about, you know, surviving cancer is so much harder than going through cancer, in my opinion, because there's no guidebook on how to pick up your life after this. There's no guidebook on how to process these emotions. Or honestly, growing up, you know, when I was 20, it sounds so silly, but having this scar was like the worst thing that could have happened to me. I felt like Frankenstein. I mean, I would look in the mirror and I would just hysterically sob and I'd be like, oh my God, I have all these scars. I have all these marks. Like, I look like a monster. How am I ever going to have sex with someone? That was like my first thought. I was like, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to get intimate with someone after this, because I just felt so monstrous. And I really wasn't used to seeing that new body in the mirror, which I think is something a lot of cancer patients have to deal with after, you know, especially with breast cancer.
Even without scars though, because you've been through the experience and you've been through treatment, your body image is changed. No matter, even if it's outwardly not, inwardly it is. So I think almost everyone who has experienced cancer has experienced what you're saying.
It's just like with jewelry, with like makeup, like these things are part of your identity. So I think a lot of us go through this weird identity loss. And then after cancer, they're like, well, who am I? I have no idea. Like I've turned into this new person with a new perspective and I don't really know who she is anymore. But you think you're going to go back to normal. Reality is there's no more normal. Like you are going to have to create a whole new life. And adjustment for yourself, which for some people that could be really anxiety inducing. I love change, so I felt like I handled it very well. I ended up getting on meds because I was so depressed. I couldn't even get out of bed. And, you know, it was around the time of my breakup. So honestly, I don't feel like cancer is necessarily the thing that pushed me over the edge. It was my relationship ending that really did it for me, because it was like I lost my hair. I lost medical school. I lost the way I look. I lost my confidence, my self-image, who I am, my identity, my friends. I lost a lot of friends. So for me, it was just like, now I lost the person that I thought I was going to spend forever with. Like I felt so lost. I felt like I didn't have anyone. My parents didn't really understand. You know, God bless my parents. They're beautiful people, but they're old. So for them, they're like, just, you should be over it by now. Right. And I'm like, it just doesn't work that way. I'm never going to be over it. Cancer is part of who I am at this point. I'm never going to get over it. There's not a single day I don't remember it. There's a straight up reminder on my chest. Like it's not something I can escape. So yes, for my parents, it happened 6 years ago. For me, it happened yesterday.
It's like you're on this two-lane road with your journey where part of you feels like cancer, as you said, was a blessing and how it changed your outlook and your perspective of things. And then the other lane is the survivorship issues and dealing with those and realizing that treatment, the end of treatment isn't the end of like, oh, we're back to normal. It's a whole different life now and a different person. Yeah.
Completely different.
Yeah.
And honestly, I always tell people it took me 5 years to start processing cancer. It really took until last year, and it's because I have an insanely supportive partner now who allowed me to stop working, allowed me to finish school, and allowed me to do absolutely nothing for a few months. And that was nice because honestly, I had to go through, I had to go through college while I was going through treatment because my college paid for my treatment.
That's incredible. That's wonderful.
I had a scholarship. I was full tuition and I paid for university insurance. And their plan was so good. I do not have medical bills from cancer to this day.
Wow. That's amazing.
So much. But the only caveat was I had to stay in school throughout treatment or else I would lose the insurance. I never had a break. From the moment I got diagnosed to the second I graduated, I never stopped.
Wow.
And one hand, I didn't want to survive, but on the other hand, I did. And it was just, like you said, that two-lane road. It was like, which one am I going to pick? Am I going to be picked to be miserable in my diagnosis? Or am I going to like suck it up and just try to be better? Because God gave me a second chance at something. Well,
and I think people shift between the lanes. I mean, it's never a linear trajectory. It is a continuous dynamic shift. And it's, okay, how do I get myself back into the right lane? And I think you were talking about with counseling, therapy, support groups, those help you get back into the lane that helps you enjoy life.
Yeah, 100%. They give you so many more coping mechanisms. And I think for me, I really just needed time. And I think that is the same for a lot of people. Like And you're right. There are times where you're going to shift back and forth. But that's, mm-hmm. I think if we normalize it and just kind of make it known, like, hey,
uh-huh.
you're going to be good sometimes. You are going to absolutely try to ruin your life other times. Just go with it. Like, just that's part of healing, honestly. Like, it's never pretty. It's right. never easy. It's never smooth. And again, it took me 5 years to finally get back to work, find some purpose in my life, mm-hmm. and actually feel not happy that I got cancer, but like, I love who I am right now. Like,
I'm so glad to hear that.
She's went through a lot. And there were times where I didn't like myself, but I think that's just all of us. Like, all of us have periods where we're going to be great. There's periods where we're going to suck. And we just kind of got to roll with it, because life, we can't just be like, oh, poor me. Blah, blah, blah. Yes, my story was really traumatic and it shouldn't have happened. And it's very different than other cancer stories. But I don't feel like, why me anymore? And I mm-hmm. did for a while in the beginning. I was a 4.0 student. I was just so focused on my work. I didn't have any friends. None. You know, I was so focused on my schooling and what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But like, maybe that wasn't healthy. Maybe it wasn't right for me. Maybe there are other things that are better for me. And I think having cancer at that time in that location, like, everything was just.
Some of the things we talked about too, and you talk about how you have a great partner, is dating after cancer and dealing with the changed person you are. And how do you broach that conversation?
Yeah, I think it was really hard for me because at the time I was 20. 21, I would say mm-hmm. I started getting back into dating around 21, 22. And I just felt like nobody could really relate to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people that could relate to me were people that were just as troubled as me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how I ended up with a drug addict, right? Because like, for me, it was just like, okay, nobody can relate to me on any level that is close in my age. And a lot of these people, especially in my age group now that I'm 26, they mm-hmm. want to start having families.
Mm-hmm.
They want to start having kids, getting married, and all these things. And it's like, I'm just starting my life again. I just literally started getting back my job. You know, my relationship I've been in for 2 years now. He's mm-hmm. he's awesome. I could not have asked for a better partner. But if I didn't find him, I would probably still be single right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he also had kind of a rough upbringing, but he dealt with it way better than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like having someone that went through a difficult time and wasn't using drugs to escape, wasn't using other things, any type of escapism, mm-hmm. and is just working on becoming a better person helped me tremendously to get back on track. So I think, especially after surviving, it is really important who you end up dating, mm-hmm. because that person can literally either make your recovery way easier, way smoother, or they can absolutely ruin your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are so in such a vulnerable place,
right?
A lot of us. And there are people that will prey on that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are either going to be like, hey, I think you're a great person, but you're infertile. I can't do that. Or, hey, I really like you. You're a great person, but the likelihood you're going to get cancer again, I don't think I can handle that. I don't think I could be the kind of person that you want me to be. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because you're having these conversations on your first date before yeah. someone even attaches themselves to you.
Right.
It's way easier to convince someone to go through cancer with you if you've been together for a few years.
Right.
But if you just met, they're like, right?
Really?
It's
yeah.
so different.
Yeah. And dating's so hard enough as it is, let alone having to put this out there. So how do you broach that? How do you bring that up with, I mean, how did you, because you've been with someone for 2 years now.
Yeah. I'm an oversharer. So
you just put it out there.
Yeah. It's all over my social media. The first thing you see when you look up my Instagram is heart cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And all over my social media, I try my best to show I survived cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I survived cancer. And I think what really helped me with my partner that I have now was the fact that we met through mutual friends.
Yeah.
So he already knew about my situation.
Right.
And I think, you know, there are going to be some people who care And there's going to be some people who don't give a shit. And they're just like, I see you as a human being. Because you know what? Anyone could get cancer. And that's kind of how my partner is. So again, I like to just get it off the table ASAP. I don't like to be coy about it because I'm just like, you know what? I want someone to be like, fuck yes. No question. I don't want them to be like, maybe I can handle that. I don't know if I can handle that. No, I want you to know from the second you meet me. So if you do fall in love with me, you already know what I'm about. You already know what you're going to have to deal with probably. And that was one of the first things I said to my partner. You know, the first night we met, we actually ended up talking until like 6 o'clock in the morning. It was very cute. There's going to be people that really respect the shit out of you for it. And then there's going to be people that are so scared of it. And are just going to run away. Let them run away. My biggest thing is let them know right away so they can run right away so you don't have to deal with someone that is going to be in and out of those doors. You don't need that. We really need to take care of ourselves after survivorship. So I think with dating, give yourself some time to rebuild your self-image. Go seek out therapy. I worked with a self-esteem specialist, actually.
I really
sought out someone that was specifically in self-esteem because it's something I always struggled with. And I think it's something all women struggle with from a young age. So I went to go seek out that kind of specialty. And once I was able to rebuild my self-esteem and my self-worth, that's when I was able to find a partner that was able to handle me and what my baggage and what I come with. But I think I would say seek a therapist for self-esteem issues for sure before dating. And I know it's hard because honestly, after treatment, you just want to hug someone. You just want to cuddle with someone. You just want to date someone. You just want to be told you're pretty. But those are just bandages. You know, it's not really going to fix the issue. And then you become very dependent on them emotionally. And then instead of going through cancer, now you're going through a very toxic codependent relationship. It's like substituting one trauma for another. So I think as cancer patients, we need to be very careful with who we allow in our lives. And again, I would try to be straight up about it right off the bat because I think the worst thing you can do is waste any more time. We've already wasted so much time being sick, struggling. Let your cards all out on the table. You let someone know what you're going to need from them, the support you're going to need. I always tell my partners from the get-go, I'm not 100%. I cannot clean your house. I cannot cook for you. But cleaning actually is very taxing for me. And I'm very lucky to have someone that's like, okay, let's split chores then. Let's actually work together to make it so that this is like a harmonious union. And not like we're like bound by a duty to do something. Right. And I find that finding someone you can be very, very open with and transparent with is probably the number one key to success in future relationships after cancer, because you need someone you can be completely honest with. Because you're going to, if you, God forbid, you know, if you go through it again, you're going to need to talk to your partner. So I think it's a good thing to just be upfront about it.
Yeah. I mean, before they are invested in you too, and then all of a sudden they're having to reevaluate that, that's got to be tough for that person too. So I agree with you. And actually there's a social worker from Dana-Farber who very much says the same thing. Say it up front, just say it up front so that neither invests time. And it's hard. I mean, it is very hard having really painful sex. How has that been mitigated for you, or what have you done, if you don't mind me asking? And if you don't want to answer, that's fine.
So it's really interesting. I don't know if this is like a God in the universe thing, but weirdly enough, when my ex and I broke up, it just went away.
I wonder if there was like some kind of psychological thing going on
there. That's what I think so too. I mean, I don't know 100%. It did feel very dry. And another thing that
I'm sure it was
utilized
chemo,
was
chemo and radiation.
Please go get yourself some lubricant. Mean, it definitely helps.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a lot of different, especially nowadays, there's so many different things you can use. Get some stimulation toys, like get whatever you need to do. Don't be ashamed of bringing things into the bedroom in your relationship because, you know, the partner that I was with at the time, he was very vanilla. And so was I. I was a kid. We were so young. You know, what is a vibrator? I didn't even know. So for me, it was like, I didn't really know how to combat that. And I feel like if I had more resources, maybe that could have, it could have corrected itself. But at that time, I just genuinely didn't know. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to give it time. Maybe this is just a temporary chemo thing. And it turns out maybe it was. But in the future, I kind of prepared myself because I started to get really anxious when it came to having sex.
Sure. If it hurts. Like, yeah.
Exactly. So every single time I would go into it, I'd be like, I'd brace myself. And I feel like that's just coming into that psychologically is already going to make a bad experience. So I prepared. I got vibrators. I got lube. I started to read up a lot on – I started to read a lot on the vagina, just like how it functions. Actually started delving into premenopause because I started getting convinced maybe it was a premenopause thing.
I could see why.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they did warn me about it, and I lost my period. So I was like, maybe it's that. But I don't think it was. But they did give me some really good tips, actually, just looking up online, like, why do women experience this? Are there ways around it? And then I started learning about different conditions that can actually make sex painful. So that's when I recorded everything. And I was like, okay, if this doesn't get better within like 6 months, I'm going to record these symptoms, go to the doctor, and maybe the chemo gave me these conditions.
And it very well can. Right. It very well can. Chemotherapy can do that. Radiation therapy, absolutely. And, but like you have found, there can be ways around it. And practicing regular vaginal moisturizing, that makes a big difference. Regular stimulation, penetration, gentle penetration with lubricant that's irritant free.
Yes. And it's so, totally okay to check. Yeah. Maybe you need a more water-based one.
Yes.
I feel like my partner, because he was so young, I don't think he understood like what going in soft meant.
Right.
I don't think he understood like what was going on. And you know, I'd be like, hey, go slow. And he'd be like, I am.
But even like, Or even like you brought up with toys, with intimate, and you don't have to have vaginal penetration every single time. You can still enjoy intimacy other ways, or introduce, pun intended, introduce the less wide toy, intimate toy first to kind of get things going.
That's smart.
Yeah.
And that's something I think because people aren't having these conversations.
Right.
Is that people aren't aware of it. And also, too, it takes two.
It does.
I can tell my partner everything in the world. If they're not receptive and they're not willing to, you know, make changes accordingly, it's just not going to work out.
Right.
And I feel like that's something a lot of us honestly go through because they do get a little insecure about it. Like, oh, am I not good enough?
Right.
And it's like, bro, it has nothing to do with you. It has literally nothing to do with you.
Right.
And I think that's where choosing your partner wisely comes back again and going into dating again. Like it's a little uncomfortable, but have these conversations like right off the bat.
Communication.
If someone loves you, they will totally, or even if they dig you, they're totally open to having that conversation. And they're probably going to appreciate it, honestly.
Right. So that communication is so important of saying, it's not you, it's that my body's changed a little bit, so we need to just have patience with my body. And we need to play a little bit more, which can be fun. That's another way to spin it. And,
so
you
necessary.
Know, and it's like, it's not you. It's truly me, but we're going to make it work, or we're going to work together to figure out ways around how it's not working so that we can both enjoy each other's company.
It's another thing, birth control after survivorship.
Yeah.
I'm not on birth control. I refuse to take any hormonal birth control. Again, that's a conversation I had to have on my first date. Like, it's just, there are so many things that changed after cancer that I was like, no, this needs to be addressed on a first date. I don't care how awkward it is. And anyway, if someone else can't handle my reality, I don't want them to be part of my reality.
Right.
You know?
Because you can't change it. Exactly. You can't change it for them.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And like, trying to is just going to make you miserable, and it's right. just not going to be a good time.
That's such a good point. Oh yeah, my gosh. Trying to change, so it's going to make you miserable.
It's going to make you miserable. Yeah. Cause at this point it's like, you're trying to fit into something that like, it's just not meant for you. You know, he's let him go. He's better for someone else. And right. there's someone literally way right. better for you. Yeah. So, I think that's really important.
It is. So I want to know, I'm dying to know, how did you become a fan of cows?
Oh my God. Yes. cows. I freaking love cows. First of all, I've always loved burgers.
So okay.
That's my favorite food. I'm so American. I freaking love burgers. And I remember I went to Colombia, which is my mom's native country. Uh-huh. And my grandma, she has a farm. My mm-hmm. mom was a farm girl. She grew up on a farm. My grandma was a farm girl and she grew up on a farm. And her mom before that, it's just like been in our whole family for generations. And so I went there. I was really excited. It is a beautiful country. I always tell everyone, like, go visit Colombia. Like, you will not come home. And I was expecting to see horses because I liked horses. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any freaking horses. I was just so pissed. Like, I saw horses of other farms and I was like, yeah, like, I'm so excited. I'm going to ride horses. And then I got to my grandma's farm and all I see are a bunch of cows. And I'm just like, where are the horses? Like, this is so disappointing. And I guess my grandma could sense I was really upset. You know, kids can't hide when they're upset. Because I was right. like 7 at this point, right. 7, 8, 9. I went back a few times to visit. So I did get to see the horses, the cows, my cows multiple times. Yeah. It was really nice. And she was like, no, don't worry about it. Like, cows and horses are exactly the same. Like, you can't even, there's no difference. I was like, what the fuck is she saying? I was like, well, first of all I know is that horses have hair you can braid. How am I going to braid this cow? Like, I was just so upset. Here I was thinking I was going to, like, live out a little princess fantasy, ride on the horse, braid it, comb her hair. That's not what happened. And so I started hanging out with the cows. And, like, every day when you come into the farm, the cows moo at you.
They're saying hello. They know you, right? Yeah.
They really, like, once you're there more than 3 times, they start to say hi to you when you get on the farm. And I was like, this is really cute. Like, all you hear is, whoa. And I'm like, oh, hey. Hey, Melissa.
Hey.
You know, and I had all different names for them, but, like, I couldn't tell who was who because, you know, granted, there's so many freaking cows. And, you know, they were all Melissa to me at this age. And then another thing I thought that was so cute that they did is I learned how to milk. Mm-hmm. You know, so they wait for their friend until they get done being milked. So it's like no one ever goes in being milked alone.
Aww. You always have like a little supporter. I didn't know that.
It's really cute. And like, granted, I don't know if it's just my grandma's weird ass cows that do this, but like they were just really social with each other. Mm-hmm. They were like so clicky. Mm-hmm. And the more I hung out with them, the more I was like, oh my God, these are like human beings. Like they would literally, it was always pairings. I learned later that cows do have best friends.
So now I'm like, I didn't know this.
Cows have best friends and they're actually just as good as reading human emotions as horses are. Now I understand what my grandma was trying to say. Because if you're upset, they know. They will try and cheer you up. They will go to you. They'll sit next to you. And the way they sit is just so cute. I don't know if you've ever seen a cow sit. Mm-mm. It looks like the way a dog sits, except these are huge animals. So it just looks hilarious.
So they come and sit next to you.
They come and sit next to you.
Oh my gosh.
They'll lay their head on your lap.
Oh.
They're very affectionate. So I just kind of totally fell in love with them. I was like,
I could see why.
Right? I was like, they remind me so much of humans and the way we socialize.
Oh.
They can sense when you're afraid. They can sense when you're upset. And I was just like, wow, like, this is really cool. So then ever since that trip, I was just so obsessed with cows. I loved them. And I was like, well, this is great because they're tasty too. How it ended up as part of my branding is I was like, you know what? I've never seen anyone use cows.
There you go.
Ever. And I don't think people understand how social they are. And just like how like us right. they are, they really do have that like herd mentality. And I also think it's really cute that they chase dogs. I think they think they're dogs.
Maybe they do. Yeah.
I really think they think they're big dogs because whenever they would see dogs play, and I keep them at my desk. I do keep them at my desk. And the cow obsession just never went away. Yeah, every single time I see a cow, I'm just very reminded of my grandma and her farm.
You ever just like walk into somebody's field to make friends with their cows?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I always do. And then,
oh, wow. I love it.
Come up to me and they're like, usually the people go for the horses. I was like, yeah, I go for the cows. And they always think I'm like vegan or something. And I'm like, absolutely not. I would totally eat one of your cows. Like, absolutely not. I love dairy. I love everything about cows.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I got into my cow branding.
I love it. Sal, this has been such a treat.
It's been so fun.
Oh, I'm so glad. You were nervous. And here you are. You did great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing so much of yourself and so much hope for other people. And so just incredible wisdom on how to be on this journey. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the space to talk about it.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. It's just been fantastic. It really has been. Hello. The Everything Cancer podcast is here to help you communicate better with your healthcare team. Any information presented on the Everything Cancer podcast is not intended to be used as medical or healthcare advice. Please address your healthcare concerns with your healthcare team. The staff at Everything Cancer podcast will not be answering questions directly related to healthcare. Thank you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being part of the Everything Cancer podcast community.